What's love got to do with it? What's love but a second-hand emotion? What's love got to do with it? Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken?
Yeah, well, this is not about blues and a love story. Sorry to disappoint you. But then again, maybe it is. Because the question that we ask, really, because it is so overdone, as it were, it is so tired in some instances, this use of our word love, that we get so confused when it comes time to understand the import of a commandment like this, the import of a story of God's commitment to the world and to God's people. On a level of emotion, how on earth are we ever going to meet this call, this commandment to love God with all that we have, to love our neighbor, if it's about emotion? Because we have had our hearts broken over and over again, disappointed when we try to muster what is necessary in order to broach that gap between us and others, in order to establish a firm connection. And so the first thing that we need to do is to disabuse ourselves of the notion that the love being spoken of here has anything to do with emotion, or anything primarily to do with emotion. It's not that love as emotion is inappropriate or wrong in normal social and relational intercourse. No, it is that love as it is conceived in this commandment, as Jesus intended, as God demonstrates it, is not about emotion. So we need to get that right if we're even going to have a hope of understanding what it is to which we're called. And you've heard this before, and so sometimes, even now, perhaps even in your minds, you're starting to switch off because, you know what? I know that commandment already. I've heard it preached upon. I've read it myself. That what else could be said about it? And I would suggest to you that you, like me, are bombarded with notions of love that have little to do with what this is speaking of. We have to go to those noble places of not only great literature and poetry, but biblical understanding of the power of this gifting that God is calling us to. You see, what's happened, as I've said in the introduction to the gospel reading, is that Jesus has been encountering the power structure. The events that we have been reading about have happened during the final week leading up to Jesus' crucifixion. He has come into Jerusalem, and as a result of that, has found himself in deep dispute with those who are seeking to keep the status quo. Jesus has come to expose, as it were, the by rote adherence of the law, the way in which crustaceans, as it were, has become encrusted with all kinds of applications that miss the spirit of what God intends. And so he comes on a donkey to make a parable of the might and strength, if you will, of the emperor and the empire. He comes into the temple and overturns the tables and draws attention to the heart of what God intends for worship. He speaks to them using parables that challenge them. And the Sadducees, and last week we heard of the Herodians, and now the Pharisees are each having a knock and whack at him. You wonder if Jesus is not growing tired of such. I couldn't help but think that it was similar to that which we preoccupy ourselves with to some extent today on television fare. It's being called by some the culture of humiliation. All of these so-called reality shows that are anything but real. They're so contrived, and producers tell, well, stop, we have another take. So it may be that Jesus is being put through the ringer here. They're trying to see if he can sing well enough not to get voted off, sing off. Or if he can dance well enough not to be sent packing, as it were, on So You Think You Can Dance. Or he can cook well enough not to be humiliated on Cooked. Or maybe they're trying to put him in a wetsuit and get him climbing over all kinds of weird, gooey stuff that he can be knocked off with spinning wheels and wipe out. They are trying to make a spectacle The one whom we have heard sung about today is the stone, the bedrock of our faith. Jesus will have none of it. Because what is at issue is his identity. What is at issue is the core of the story he's come to be and to tell. And so they come, they marshal their forces. It's interesting, the word that's used there, they gather, they congregate. It's a sinister overtone. The Pharisees have seen what Jesus has done in dismissing the Sadducees, and now they come to take their turn at him. And they ask a trick question, because we know the motives. Which one is the greatest of all the commandments? Which is the greatest of the laws? Now in that day, there was great debate about whether there was one or two or three or five that rose to the top, as it were, of all the 613 commandments. Others were saying, no, you can't pick one. They're all important. They're all given by God. You pick one and you are in error, for you have demeaned the word of God in other commandments. So that debate was raging, and they come now to get Jesus, to pin himself down, to find a way in which he could trip himself up. Which one is the greatest? You see, the commandments in those days, the 613 of them, were divided in a particular way in order to help people remember, as it were. There were 365 you shall not, thou shall not. 365 specifically to remind people every single day of what they were to refrain from doing, what they had to be careful of every day. And then 268 thou shalls, or you shall, which was the number of bones in our body, to remind them that in experience and in life, every single day, all of our being is meant to be wrapped up in seeking to obey God. That's how they were divided. But there's also the danger of following these commandments by rote to such an extent that one misses the spirit and the grace. And what happens when love, who is God, trumps it all. And so Jesus quotes from the very law to which they refer, and Jesus, as a rabbi and a teacher, a Jewish male, is able to do that, to wrestle with the text indeed. And he quotes from Deuteronomy, from the Shema, one of the holiest and most regularly practiced and recited prayers in Judaism. Shema Israel, hear, O Lord, the Lord your God is one, or the Lord your God alone, as some other Hebrew scholars translate that. Thou shalt love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. And in Deuteronomy it says strength, but Jesus changes it to mind. And the second is like that. You shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. Now we need to understand that love, as it's articulated here, is not emotion, as we said. This love is an act of commitment, an act of will. Agape is the word that is used almost consistently within the New Testament to describe this love. It is a supreme kind of love that comes as the activated will and the commitment of one's life and priorities to the well-being of the other. It has nothing to do with how you feel about the other person. Nothing to do about what you think about the other person. It has to do with a commitment in obedience to God, and it is an attempt to see the other as God sees the other, not as we do. Now you say, well, that's all fine and good, but how can that be? We are not God. You're right. And so this commandment that Jesus sums up into one, but it is really two, is an invitation to aim as high as we can aim, knowing that we will not reach that all the time. Knowing that it is impossible in our own effort and energy to love God with everything we have and our neighbor. But it is to remind us what is the trajectory and the end and desired result of what we're called to be and to do. And so it is broken down. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, the seat of decision. Heart, understood within Jewish thinking, is not what you have most passion about in terms of feelings and emotions, but that which is at the seat, at the core of your decision making. I'm reading as one of a number of devotional books, one called The Monastery of the Heart by Joan Chichester. And she talks about the various ways in which the heart is invited into obedience and followership to God. And one of the things she says I'd like to share with you is, we are all seekers of the God who is here, but invisible to the blind eye, who calls us but is unheard by those who do not listen, who touches our lives wherever we are but is unfelt by those whose hearts are closed to the presence of God, who is everywhere, in everyone, at all times. In the monastery of the heart, we are challenged to exchange all those empty ideas for the depth of reflection, the calm of thought, the clarity of insight, that silence that brings in its wake to the soul that longs in silence for it to come. It is an invitation to go deep. We are to love God with all our heart, with all the capacity that we have to make a decision for love, to make a decision that is infused by the perspective and the power of God for love. That is hard. In fact, it's almost impossible were it not for the grace and the strength of God and God's Spirit. We are also to love God with all our soul, our life. Now, the soul, interesting thing about the soul, various ways of understanding it, but it suggests that it's at the core, as it were, of the place where God can most unadulteratedly communicate with us. Where we, if we are able to access and to go deeply in reflective, meditative, prayerful life, receive those ministrations, those revelations from God. We do that supported in community. For when we are clear in our soul what truly and really matters, the rest of it follows suit. And that is why if our hearts are grasped, our soul is grasped, our lives and actions become much more possible to fall in line. And so Jesus changes it and includes the mind. The mind. It's interesting how these things all fit together. The heart, remember Jesus says that where your treasure is, your heart is also. So our heart's preoccupations have something to do with what we treasure. Think about what comes into your heart as you sit by the light waiting for it to change, as you stand over the sink gazing out the window washing dishes, as you just are about to fall asleep, as you're off for your walk and your life is filled with all kinds of intrusions, what is it that preoccupies you over and over and over again? That's your treasure. That's your treasure. That's where your heart is preoccupied. The commandment in Jesus is saying, let that be captured. Let that be captured by the love of God. Let that be captured by the imagination of what is possible about how you can help others, how you love your neighbor. John Chrysostom, one of the ancient Christian writers, says, let us startle them. Let us startle them by the way we act. Speaking of the Christian community and its public witness, for those things that we are working on in our lives, in heart, soul, and mind, become operationalized in the way in which we devote to God and the way in which we treat others. Now, I have to tell you, this is way easier said than done. I was thinking this week as I was preparing this that I've come to thank God for this. I have to keep coming back to it, and I've shared this with the congregation before. There are incidents and people in my life that have done things that have caused me to be, let's say, not the most loving in mind towards. Is that a good way of putting it? One of which actually is a mechanic, an auto mechanic in Montreal when I was living there who robbed me. And why I give thanks for this memory, and I've prayed about it, and I'm sure I've forgiven him, but it just keeps coming back because there's something about it that just keeps eating away at me. I can see his face, his charming, wily, crook-like smile. I can see it. In fact, I saw him one time on the road after he had gotten away and disappeared from the garage he was working at. I saw him on the road driving next, and I had this emotion in me. I said, "Lord, help me." Because I wanted to take my car and ram it in the side of him. I did. I confess. Because it was a lot of money. It was an engine job. And he took me, you know. But why I remember that and why I recall that is because it reminds us not only about the near impossibility of living into this commandment by ourselves on our own strength, but it reminds us that we will be given ample opportunity day in and day out to recommit and re-engage and swear again allegiance to God and allegiance to this law of love, which is grace. So never believe that you have it solved, that you know it in and out. Because this business of loving God in all our heart, the Hebrew is an interesting thing. Love God in all your heart, in all your life, your soul, in all your strength, in all your mind, in all. And that little word with three letters makes all the difference. All. There's no part of your heart, your mind, your life, your strength that is to be reserved or withheld from this wholesale commitment to devotion to God and God's priorities. There's no part of your heart, my heart, life, mind, and strength that is to be withheld from seeking the well-being of another. And who is a neighbor? We've already had that settled. Every human that you and I share this earth with, without reserve. So you can say with me, that's impossible. That is so impossible. And we will hear Christ saying to us, "In a sense, you're right, but it is possible through my power and through God's Spirit. It is possible to aim there. It is possible to organize there. It is possible to jointly as a congregation commit and encourage each other there. It is possible to rehearse ample opportunities every day there." So we live in between, trying to live into that and recognizing how significantly we fail. And it looks foolish because that is not the moral code under which the world operates. So let us, like Gandalf said in Lord of the Rings, let folly be our cloak. So let us look foolish. Let us look foolish in the eyes of the world, loving God with all we've got. Let us look foolish loving our neighbor as we love ourselves. Madeleine Engel said that we could change the world if everyone loved their neighbor as God would have us. We could. Last Sunday, as we were in church talking about swearing our allegiance again to God, at that moment, there was being dedicated on the Washington Mall the monument to Martin Luther King Jr. Someone whose life, as imperfect as all of ours is, demonstrated the active commitment that is love. In the face of bombings, in the face of threat, in the face of imprisonment and abuse, dogs set upon him, he held firm to this law. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. Even love your enemies. In our scripture today from Thessalonians, Paul also rehearsed this. Paul actually believes this teaching of Jesus. Because the enemies who were seeking to undermine him, he recalls when he first went to the Christians in Thessalonica. He had just come from being beaten and being harassed and imprisoned in Philippi.
And he came there, he says, just like a nursing mother, to care for them in gentleness, not demanding from them, not beating them over the head with any kind of religious doctrine. He came to share, as he says, our lives and the gospel with you. Gently, kindly, graciously. We can, because there are ample examples, both in our lives, in this congregation, in the history of Christian witness, of those who have believed and trusted the call to love God with everything and the call to love neighbor. We desperately need each other's help to do that. For God's Spirit has called us into community to make it so. And the final thing I want to say that I noticed in the text, Jesus, in summing that up, says, on these two commandments, or on this commandment that he brings together, hangs all the law and prophets. That word is so significant, hangs. It's the same word that is used to describe Jesus' crucifixion, hanging on a cross. Could it be that Jesus is already alluding to the fact and the truth that to love God and neighbor so radically, so passionately, so devotedly is going to mean that we will encounter crucifixion. We will have our reputations derided. We will be called silly and naive. There will be crucifixion in those who seek to live that way. I think that Jesus is hinting at the sacrifice involved in loving God with all we have and neighbor as ourselves. And even as we join each other by the Spirit's grace and strength to commit to that, we hold on to the hope and the joy that resurrection is more powerful than crucifixion. And therefore, love triumphs.